This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 16th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 140th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This show, by hook or by crook, seems to be about being transported on flights of fancy, by works of the imagination, by the visual, by the aural, sometimes by machines whose job it is to move people, sometimes just by the suggestion of them. Let's see. Let's hear. Who to Film an Unfilmable Book. Ralph Larson's The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet becomes the young and prodigious T.S. Spivet, with Amelie director Jean-Pierre Jeunet at the helm. He'll drop in to talk genius.
I never made any compromises in all my film, in seven films. And I am very proud about that.
We'll take a trip to the former wind tunnels, where science and research now allow artists' imaginations to run wild.
What we were trying to find was an interpretation of these machines that would be the core of some imaginative reuse of the building.
Plus, we'll head to Beirut to find out what it takes for a Lebanese indie band to make it big. We're at the grand opening of the new Foyles building in London, one of Britain's most beloved bookstores. And there's live music from Hot Chips' Alexis Taylor. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Music first, and this week we're joined by a truly unique talent. Having made his name in the electro-pop hit factory Hot Chip, lead singer Alexis Taylor has branched out into something a little more restrained for his new solo album, Await Barbarians. Setting aside the grooves, he stripped his songs down to something at times almost indecently intimate. He came into the Monocle Studios fresh off an Australian DJ tour to play us a few tracks, and here he is first with his brand new single, Without a Crutch.
La 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 la. If I don't know where I am today, it's not because I'm far away, or even cause I drink too much. Well, then again, not quite in love, I try to put it to the world. Instead of what our love deserves, or maybe we just slip too much. How can I stand without a crutch? La 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 la. La 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 la. And what would all our friendship say if we bled it all away? It's not as if our hearts are tough. Why do we rub ourselves this rough? It's hard to know where this came from. And if it's best left out of song, I don't await barbarians. They never leave their maskings on. La 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 la. You're a stone and my paper's rough, but scissors this blunt still can cut. It's not a game we're playing here. The die's not cast, but it rolls to live. La 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 la.
That was Alexis Taylor, Without a Crutch. It's from his new record, Await Barbarians. And of course, we'll have more from him later on in the show. Rafe Larson's genre-defying novel, The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet, about a prodigiously talented 12-year-old inventor and mini-autodidact, wowed readers and studio executives alike. But who should direct the hyper-imaginative world of this little master? Why, someone like Jean-Pierre Jeunet, of course, the man behind Amelie and Delicatessen, and whose visual style is the equivalent to the flights of Heath Robinson fancy in Larson's novel. Renamed as the young and prodigious T.S. Spivet and starring the amazing Kyle Catlett as the young genius and Helena Bonham Carter as his batty mum, it's a wonderful, charming film that seems sculpted from the stone of pure imagination. I had a chat with director Jean-Pierre Jeunet after a screening in London a couple of weeks ago.
In the Spivet family, every member is one of a kind.
No! Not my Japanese! No!
My father has a soul and mindset of a cowboy. And my mother thinks of herself as a great naturalist. How on earth they fell in love is a mystery. They're like day and night. There's my sister Gracie with her dreams of stardom. Then there's me, T.S., a gifted child and scientist.
It's a pain for me because now I never read a book just for the pleasure. Immediately I'm thinking about an adaptation. I often give up a book because I think, no, it's not a film. And it's too bad because I love to read. And for this book, I hired a guy to read for me. And he sent me the book during, I was in Australia for commercial, and he said, you have to read very quickly.
And I guess the rest has become history, at least for you, 2 or 3 years in the making of this movie. When you read it, did you think immediately this needs to be done in a different way?
Yeah, of course.
I think it's got a beautiful look like your other movies, but the 3D is a big change for you.
Because the book is full of sketches supposed to be made by T.S. Spivet, and gave me immediately the idea to make in 3D. I thought, and I said to Ralph Larson, the author of the book, of the novel, I told him it would be great to have the invention, T.S. Spivet's invention, floating in the air, because what we like in 3D, of course, it's beautiful when it's well done, but you would like to catch the object floating in the air. That's a real pleasure for kids and for adults as well.
I know it's a French-Canadian co-production. That's where the production comes from, the money. But it's essentially, it's a road trip, or it's a rail trip from Montana to Washington, D.C.
It's an American movie, but it's a fake American movie. And it's very important for me because I wanted to make a European movie just to keep the freedom. Because, you know, the role of the game in USA is different. I made Alien Resurrection, a big Hollywood movie. Yeah. And the role is different completely. You don't have the final cut. When I make my own film, I have the final cut. I never made any compromises in all my film, in 7 films. And I am very proud about that.
It seems to portray an America of fat cops chasing children around a very beautiful landscape. It's a kind of old-fashioned idea of America.
Yeah.
Are these elements that you've drawn from the book, or is this something that you wanted to kind of... This was obviously your own visual identity that you wanted to stamp on that character.
Half in the book, half in our memory, the global memory, because you know, everybody knows American movies. And my wife is American, by the way, so I travel a lot in America. So it's a mix of the America we dream about.
And I guess going back to the 3D element and the visual look of the film, you've got the inside of a child's head to play with. How similar is Spivet's head to Jeunet's head?
Oh, I could say I am T.S. Spivet somewhere. I am not a genius like him, but I love like him to make my own sketches in my house. I don't live in a ranch in Montana, but in a house in Provence. And sometimes I win a award, I have to fly, I don't take a freight train, I take an airplane, and I speak with journalists like you, like him, and I don't like that. I prefer to go back in my ranch to make my sketches.
Yeah, but you keep on attracting us out to interview you, Jean-Pierre, because these films have got such a sort of beguiling look to them. They're such beguiling stories as well. I wanted to ask you very quickly about the production design, because that's so strong. These Da Vinci-like sketches that come alive on screen. Mm. Is this something that was always part of the process for you, or part of the visual look of the film?
Yeah, I love the production design. In all my film, we won so many awards for the production design. And I work with the same people, with the same production designer. And same thing for the sound, same thing for the picture. I changed the DP, the director of photography, because they are not available. Mm-hmm. So Bruno Delbonnel, who made Amélie and The Long Engagement, made the last Coen Brothers movie and Tim Burton's movie, so he wasn't available. But I give them the same direction, and we won one more time the French César for the best picture. So I am very proud about that. I love the artistic aspect. I feel like a painter. Kurosawa was used to say, if you take one picture of a film, you should put it in a wall. It has to be like a painting. That's my philosophy. That's why.
They think I'm an adult. This trip scares me, but that's that. I'm leaving tomorrow for Washington, D.C. Dear Spirit family, I have gone for a while to do some work. Don't worry, I'll be fine.
And it does feel like your young star travels through a series of amazing American landscapes that could be photography, still photography, or they could be paintings. Mm. It happens that these pictures are in 3D and they're moving, but I guess you look at all those things the same.
Yeah, we made a lot of location scouting by train,
that must
by
have
helicopter,
been fun.
By car. And it's fun, yeah. But the nature is different. By the way, I think I prefer to shoot urban landscapes because you have perspective. The nature, you have to stay humble. You have to stay, you know, you have to be at the right moment with the right lighting. But if you put your camera 10 meters further, it's the same thing. It's not so precise. Yeah. It's just the nature is stronger than you.
There's art in so many of those landscapes. In the train station in Chicago, I think, or the docks, transport stations. Mm. They look like Bent and Hiller Becher, or they look like Andrea Skursky. These are there's a lot of sort of art.
Yeah, we use a lot of photographs.
Did you study these things to know what you wanted to do? Yeah.
And in fact, we made a mix because we shot in Montreal. And sometimes it's supposed to be Chicago. And only people from Montreal, will laugh because it's, you know, the trick works, of course. Yeah.
And finally, your young Mr. Spivet is an amazing star. I hear that was at the end of a very long casting process. Interestingly, done on all sorts of different media, Skype and different ways of casting people.
Yeah, it's very scary because if you don't find the right kid, you are a big trouble because it's a very expensive movie. And, you know, one day you are in front of your computer in Skype and you see a guy, he's too young, too little, he's 9 years old, and T.S. was 12, but he speaks 5 languages. He says, I am martial art champion under 7, I can cry on command, and he does. So you think, oh, I have to meet this kid. And he was a great kid, very special, very clever. He was interested about everything on the set, the sound, the lighting, everything. He was like T.S. Pivet. Never tired, never exhausted, never sad, he never cried. He was always very strong. A great, great kid. I think he wants to be a director, and he will.
I was going to say, that sounds like the next.
I'm afraid because he will be a concurrent, another director for me. I don't like that.
Ladies and gentlemen, T.S. Pivet.
That was Jean-Pierre Jeunet, and the film The Young and Prodigious T.S. Spivet is out now in cinemas pretty much everywhere, and I'd highly recommend it, friends. After the break, I'll be hopping on a train south of London to check out a breezy art project that's easy on the ears.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
For Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dan.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're smoothing our edges, losing all extraneous bumps and getting super streamlined now with a trip to a new art space based in former RAF wind tunnels in Farnborough, Hampshire, southern England. The wind tunnels, used to develop some of the world's most famous planes, both military and civil, was the crucible for the UK's world-leading aircraft manufacturing business after the Second World War, but has since fallen into decline. A local group, including two very cool former test pilots, have lobbied to have these buildings placed onto the protected or listed roster as places of architectural and historical interest, and rightly so. The two buildings, named with Cold War codename poetry as Q121 and R52, are being used on their re-entry into the atmosphere of the everyday, you might say, as places to show art. But not like that. Two artists, James Bridle and Thor McIntyre Burney, have made site-specific pieces that work with and wonder at the spaces they inhabit. Both are beautiful, quite haunting, and very different. James Bridle's Rainbow Plane imagines the silhouettes of planes, real and fictional, the actual and the spectral, in a former airship hangar, while Thor McIntyre Burney's sound installation plays with the unique whooshing acoustics of the tunnels, playing homage to Beatrice Harrison's 1924 broadcast, Singing with the Nightingales, the first ever outside broadcast, in fact, and using the proud songsters of the local Rushmore male voice choir to fill these military industrial caverns with sound. It needs a bit of explaining, but it's wonderful, this place. The buildings are romantic, ghostly, as beautiful as cathedrals in their way. First, here's Finn Gordon, part of the group that saved the buildings, and a former test pilot. Then it'll be Thor McIntyre Burney, one of the artists.
When we set about trying to save these incredibly important buildings as monuments to quite amazing advances in technology that were pioneered here in Britain and led the world for such a long time, we never really envisaged that they would be kept in running order. We knew one or two could be, and during the period that we were trying to save the buildings, we ensured that the power supplies to the important wind tunnels were maintained or replaced where they had been damaged. So there is the facility to possibly run these machines to do the job they were originally designed for. But in this modern era of aerodynamics done by computer, it's highly unlikely that they would be cost effective. They're extraordinarily expensive things to run. So we always had in the back of their mind, they couldn't pay for themselves, but they have to. They couldn't be government funded. We wouldn't contemplate that. In fact, we always said if we didn't think these buildings with their contents could be self-sustaining, then we wouldn't stand in the way of them being knocked down. But we do believe now that these are monuments. These are very important monuments to really an incredible period of British technology when we led the world in aerodynamics. What we were trying to find was an interpretation of these machines that would be the core of some imaginative reuse of the building that would allow it to sustain them and into the future and stimulate generations for years to come.
My name's Thor McIntyre Burney. I'm an artist.
Well, we're standing in these amazing wind tunnels. We've heard some of your work. It's haunting stuff. I wonder if it can be anything else in the space in which it is. I guess you're sort of playing with a notion of history, aren't you? There was the first ever outside broadcast by the BBC. That's one of the things you're riffing on. Maybe you could talk us briefly through your work here.
It's a large part responding to the space, working in the space with speakers and system and trying things out. I was really struck by the fact in Q121 especially that it has that kind of cathedral effect. When you stood below this, 24-foot propeller, the sense of scale it gives you, but instead of it being kind of you and God, if you like, in a cathedral, it's you and the machine. And there was something about that I thought was really fascinating. And when I tried playing the recording of the Beatrice Harrison's garden where they had recorded the nightingales on an annual broadcast, and then in 1942 they recorded, accidentally recorded this bombers, these bombers coming over, so these Lancaster and Vickers bombers. When I tried playing that in there, it suddenly, everything kind of clicked a bit, and the acoustics in the space in the return duct amplify sound, and also there's certain frequencies that become really big, and it became this big kind of immersive thing. And there was something about that, I guess the dichotomy of flight, of the kind of the beautiful and ethereal and the nature and that kind of thing of birds, and the fascination with flight going that way, and then the other side being the machine and man, and the kind of trajectory here is odd. And it is, you know, what's created here is quite dark, and there is at times it's quite intense. Suspended where the test plane would be, I created a kind of sculptural rig that is, becomes the sound source, and split this mono recording of the nightingale and bombers into three channels, and sent that back into the space. And so that's the only source that that's coming from. So where you hear it everywhere else, that's coming from that source. And then hid other speakers with the voices, which are working with some of these big vanes that go up, that bend sound, bend air around the corner. And they each create a standing wave. So if you have a speaker at the front of one of these, as you walk through the bends, you suddenly get this standing wave of sound, but it also spits it out either way. So again, it was this interplay between the old recording and the machines, if you like, and the voices and history and people.
Obviously, this was a completely original idea based around the space with which you were given for this project. It must be balm to any artist's creative process to have something like this to work in. I mean maybe I'm overstating it, but it seems like a place almost made, if not for testing planes, to test art out in.
Daunting as well, because it's epic. And so there's a certain point when you got here where you kind of go, well, it doesn't need anything, you know, it's amazing as it is. So then it was like, well, how can I pull bits out and try and work sensitively with it and pull out the kind of latent elements. But also for me, what this project's about is trying to look at how can we relook at heritage buildings in different ways, because there's this kind of trajectory that museums tend to go down, that it's almost like there's only one way that we see old buildings, and there should be other ways that we experience them. You know, and having done some work with museums before, doing sound design and things, there was always so many directives about what the learning experience was and what did you get from this thing and how do you experience stuff. Coming off of that, I didn't want to work with museums again after that. So spaces like this, for me, give you an opportunity to relook at that equation, that paradigm.
That was Thor McIntyre-Burney at the Wind Tunnel Project in Farnborough here in the UK. And if you fancy an aural adventure into the tunnels, which I'd highly recommend, the shows are on until the 20th of July. Still to come in part two, more from that intimate and woozy session from Alexis Taylor. We'll head to Beirut and find out how the city's burgeoning indie music scene is trying to head west. And Foyle's flagship bookstore in London has moved two doors down the road. It's a bookworm's dream. We're at the grand opening to take a tour. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So a bit more of that Midori House session. It's the turn of Alexis Taylor this week. He'll speak to Monocle's Paul Noble in a moment. But first up, here he is with Am I Not a Soldier?
And now that we arbitrify. How do we keep our dream alive? And when did we last make song? And when will I next hear you sing along? You are so close, but I could cry. I've not heard your voice in such a long time. We build a wall that deepens with sound, and now we're so hard to get around. We're getting thinner, but we don't die. There's more to us together than meets their eyes. My name means defender, but I am not a soldier. Speak of us as brothers, and we will grow older. My name means defender. Am I not a soldier? Speak of us as brothers, and we too will grow older. And now that we have sung our song, who will be there to put it on? To put it on? Am I so wrong? Or turn it over, see what's going on? Who will be there after we're gone? I know I'm here now, and others have marched on. My name means defender, but I am not a soldier. Speak of us as brothers, we will grow older. My name means defender. Am I not a soldier? Speak of us as brothers, and we will grow older.
Alexis Taylor, thank you very much for that session.
It was nice to play these songs. I've actually never really played them in that way before. I've just been rehearsing quite hard with a band and with various other instruments. So yeah, it was just kind of a night of trying to sleep, right. No sleep, and then came in and did that. And hopefully it doesn't sound as tired as I am.
No, it sounded very wonderful and magical and intimate. I have to tell you, I've just bought a new pair of headphones. I thought this is time to splash out on a pair of, you know, fairly good headphones. And your album was the first thing I listened to, and it was so intimate and so close. I found it a really intense listening experience.
Yeah.
Because we're used to, you know, a lot of pyrotechnics with music and with people's albums. And this was about as stripped down as it could be. What was your intentions when you were making the album?
Well, sometimes I don't really know what the end results are going to be like, you know, and I'm not really intending to make something stripped down necessarily. But for this record, I just was following the kind of mood of the songs that came my way. So none of them really go beyond about 80 BPM or something. I tried to put a lot of detail into the production and things that would sound nice on headphones, and just tried to take away things that were too sort of straightforward at times. So sometimes I would begin tracking in a certain way and then just take out everything that was the basis and then keep in everything that was the extraneous stuff, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And also just not embellish things if I didn't feel they needed to be. So the track Closer to the Elderly, originally I'd been making that with Hot Chip and it had never really kind of finished or come out. And then I just did a take just to kind of remember how the song went with a Mooga Fooga on a keyboard and a vocal. And I just thought, well, that's fine like that, really. I like the intimacy of it and I didn't really feel the need to kind of put a beat underneath it or anything. Other tracks were, you know, I was trying to make something that felt quite country on one song and I tried to like play everything myself to make it feel right. And then I thought I would go in with a band. But then in the end, I just, the band versions that we did felt too fast and didn't have the right groove and so on. So the intentions were sometimes just to kind of complete the song in the way that made sense in my head. But after a while, I started to realise it was an album that was going to be a homemade album and, you know, fairly kind of soft and quiet in tone, but not necessarily in lyrical content.
You've come in today, it's just you and a little drum machine and your lovely 80s headless guitar. How are you taking this on the road when people come and see you?
Well, there's Susumu Mukai Zongamin on synthesizer and bass, and sometimes hitting the drums with the end of his bass guitar. And then there's Sarah Jones from New Young Pony Club and Hot Chip and various other bands on keyboards and singing and drum machine, and Rob Grosvenor Smelton on drums and guitar.
The last time I saw you was at the Barbican at the fantastic William Onyebor show, which was a massive coming together of talents to sort of explore the work of this sort of long lost funky African synth musician.
Yeah.
Just tell us a bit about that, because that ended up turning into quite a big project.
Well, it was Syncane, this New York based band that were the kind of house band to play all of that music, and they were learning it all, and then they brought in Money Mark to be the keyboard player, and that's a really like great move. And I was invited to take part at the same time as various other guest vocalists, Damon and David Byrne from America and the Lejardu sisters, Kelly from Block Party. It was always something where they wanted guest singers to come along and try and reinterpret these William Onyebor songs. But for me, it was a really easy decision because I'd been listening to some of those records for the last few years, really liking them and DJing them and trying to find original copies. And then Hot Chip got asked to do a cover for the record that they've made of cover versions and remixes. So we did Atomic Bomb. And yeah, it just seemed like a fun thing to get involved with. And I really loved playing with those musicians and being back on tour with Pat Mahoney from LCD Sound System has been really good as well. And yeah, meeting Damon Albarn and David Byrne and all these different characters, you know, it's been really fun.
That was Alexis Taylor speaking to Paul Noble. His new record, Await Barbarians, is out now on Domino Records, and he's hitting the global festival circuit hard this summer. So look out for him on a stage near you. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I'm Robert Bound. Now, music in the Middle East is dominated by big, flashy commercial acts. Nancy Ajram, Haifa Wahibe, big, powerful pop icons. But over the past decade or so, new sounds have begun emerging from the region, and Lebanon in particular. Electropop, indie rock, the blues, artists who got their start performing at bars, not weddings. Of the dozens of indie bands forming and breaking up in the Middle East, only a handful ever reach a Western audience. From Beirut, Susanna George has this report on Lebanon's budding indie music scene and what it takes to make it big in the West.
On a Sunday night in the Lebanese capital, a crowd's gathering at one of the city's newest music venues, Music Hall on the Waterfront. It's decidedly laid back. Many men and women are sporting t-shirts and Converse sneakers. They're here to see a local girl made good, Yasmin Hamdan. She's back in town in the middle of a tour to promote the release of her solo album, Yanas. Next up, a sold-out show in London. But for now, she's back home in Beirut.
Celebrate
Hamdan's being called one of the most groundbreaking artists working in the Middle East today. Unlike the commercial Arabic pop that dominates radio stations here, her sound is underground and bare. It's a sound she first pioneered nearly 20 years ago, alongside Zaid Hamdan, under the name Soapkills, as Beirut was recovering from decades of civil war.
When we started Soapkills in Beirut, it was really, really, really the beginning. And I'm saying the beginning, like, we didn't even have electricity for sometimes for days. So I'm talking about a period where you didn't even have a pub. You know, you had one guy who had material that you could run from him, and not even a sound engineer.
Soapkills combined classical Arabic music with electro and trip-hop, creating a new sound, something people had never heard before. This track, Wadeh, is from the 2002 album Shiftik. But quickly, Hamdan says she began to feel claustrophobic in Beirut.
It was very difficult because we didn't fit any format, you know, and even here in Beirut, you know, Arabic radios would consider this non-Arabic. And English-speaking radios, they just don't want to promote or put any Arabic bands, even if they're doing modern or actual, you know, music or with an actual sound.
In the early 2000s, Hamdan left to Paris to pursue a solo career. But today, more than 10 years later, the indie music movement she helped pioneer is coming into its own. Over the past few years, alternative rock band Mashru Leila has been rising to prominence both regionally and in the West. Wielding a magnetic blend of edgy lyrics and an approachable sound, they've graced the cover of Rolling Stone and wrapped up a European tour. At the center of the indie music scene sits a small dark bar along the main street of the Mar Mikhail neighborhood called Radio Beirut. Here, in addition to her day job in marketing, Christine Abiasi helps host a weekly radio show dedicated to discovering new local music talent. She says she was shocked by how many new indie bands there are in Beirut these days, but only a few achieve success in the West, or even regionally. For that, she says it comes down to sales just as much as sound.
I think the ones who do are the ones who have a proper band manager. And second of all, they have some type of marketing profile, which is like some way attractive or cool in the West.
For example, with Mashru Leila, she says some of that cool marketing profile was that their lyrics dealt with homosexuality. Zaid Hamdan is the other half of Soapkills. He still lives in Beirut, working as a composer and producer.
The music scene is vibrant. The artists have so much things to express, and they're all here. But there is the step after that, the producer step, the production side that is non-existent.
He's talking about music studios, venues, even artist-friendly copyright laws.
There is no structures to value this alternative scene. The only structures there are only promote the big names, the Arabic pop stars, or the bands that succeeded internationally.
For example, the venue where Yasmin Hamdan performed on the Beirut waterfront, that's not open to new local talent. They only host artists who've already achieved success abroad.
I used to say, stay in your country, do something for your scene. I used to say that to the musicians. Today, I have to tell them, go out as soon as you can. The first opportunity, pack and leave.
And that's something that Lebanese indie bands finding success abroad have in common. They found ways to get out and tour early on in their careers. Zaid says he's thrilled to see the variety of music coming out of Lebanon these days. But he says if he could have one wish, it would be that the music would be a little less clean and a bit more angry.
I wish for the Middle East more punk bands. Where is this youth that expressed this disgust for this incredibly unfair and disastrous social situation in which we live? Where are those people? Why are all our artists dirty enough to be cool, but not dareful enough? This is the idols I look for. I want our local Pixies or David Bowie or Sex Pistols.
That, he says, is the kind of music he wants to produce. Unfortunately, despite all the turmoil in the Middle East, all the corruption and violence worthy of outrage, he admits he doesn't see truly rebellious music on the horizon.
I'm really shocked, you know. We just produce very polite and clean people, you know. They're going with the system, as if we don't believe in revolution anymore. You know, we just want to exist, do our thing, express politely and create no trouble.
For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Susanna George.
Thanks, Susanna. And you're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. After the break, we'll take a tour of the new flagship Foyles bookshop here in London, plus another track from Alexis Taylor. Stick around.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
You are listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Charing Cross Road in London is synonymous with bookshops, and one bookshop in particular, Foyles, which has existed since 1903. Now, the iconic mecca to literature has moved 2 doors down the road into the former Central St Martin's College of Art and Design building. It's an apparently short move in distance, but a huge leap forward in quality of environment. The old Foyles buildings were, to some, charming and serendipitous, and to most others, a rabbit warren of small, confusing spaces. One went into the shop hopeful of finding a book, immediately to be confronted by a labyrinth. Foyles' new home has a rich history as one of the seminal art and design schools of the 20th century. The artists Lifschutz, Davidson, Sandilands have clarified and simplified the existing building to let light in and allow it to be filled with a huge range of books. Georgina Godwin took a tour of the new space with retail operations director, sexy name for Foyles, Sean Hamilton, and lead architect Alex Lifschutz, who begins by telling us about the building.
We've got, I think, a really interesting set of spaces, small but really intriguing spaces with raised decks and galleries around it, and a place where we think there'll be talks, there'll be expositions and debates.
Let's move off now around the space and perhaps you can just tell us a little bit about it as we go. For instance, what materials mostly are we looking at? What have you used?
The floor is actually the original rosewood floor, which we retained and which has been restored. The walls are mainly white. As I say, we've cleared away some of the excessive amounts of structure from the St. Martin's days. And the bookshelves are a light colour. And we worked very, very long and hard with Foyles to decide on the colour and the nature of those bookshelves. And for us, they are a bit of a victory in terms of giving the bookseller a lot of freedom in the way in which he and they can display the books and actually organise the space. So they're used as partitions. They're used partly to divide the spaces up so that you'll see, or we'll be able to experience as we go up the floors, different kinds of space which Sean has laid out for different kinds of purpose. And that's a way in which, as architects, we finesse the problem of, well, how should this department be or that department? It's a question of what the bookseller wants at that particular moment in time.
Let's move on while, Sean, you tell us about those changing displays and how you can move the space around and what you might want to do with the space and why it might need to be moved.
The space changes as the genres change. Generally, it's looking at all different displays that can be curated and change very quickly. From shallower shelves that are lit up, to tables, to just generally a very flexible shelving structure that enables us to adapt as we need to.
We're moving through the building now, which contains 37,000 square feet of flexible retail space spread across 8 levels on 4 floors. It's the largest bookshop to open in Britain so far this century.
We're at the balustrade around the atrium, and we've got some shelves here which terminate in a sort of lectern, in a continuous lectern with some quite good lighting, so that you can flick through a book and maybe even read half a chapter or even a chapter just leaning, lounging here, whilst you also can look at all the people going up the stairs and coming down the stairs. So you can people watch, read your book, and just take a break. And it's something that we talked about, Sean, and we talked about. The bookshelf has a second function, which is that below this lectern is a large space where, at the moment, Sean's got some books that he wants people to have a look at, but there's one or two in each space. At Christmas or at special events, he can load the whole of that base up. He can turn the books to face out, as it were, so that from the atrium side, as you look up this atrium, you'll be able to see dozens and dozens of bookshelves stacked with either one copy or many copies of books that are particularly interesting.
With a range of over 200,000 books on 4 miles of shelves, Foyles are designing an app to allow customers with a smartphone to browse stock availability and to locate books within the enormous space. However, as retail operations director Sean Hamilton says, Foyles is still very much a bookshop based on traditions rather than racing headlong into the digital age.
The reason that people still come to cities and come to stores like this is because they want to meet other people. They want to see what they're doing. They want to be together with them. They want to distance themselves from them. They want to be in a social situation. And the digital age gives you very little of that experience. If really the digital phenomenon was to take off, we'd all be living in towns like Basingstoke, I suspect, although I don't really want to diss Basingstoke, and ordering our books on a certain retailer and waiting for a delivery man to arrive. It's not a very sensual way of enjoying culture.
As with libraries, a bookshop in the middle of a community is a cross between an emergency exit, a life raft, and a festival. These are the cathedrals of our mind. These are the hospitals of our soul and the theme parks of our imagination. And this one is just about to make me pregnant with its sexiness, and I'm going to give birth to a load of tiny paperbacks. Thank you very much.
One person who's always found Foyles very sensual is writer Catlin Moran, who told me a little of her history with the shop when I caught up with her at the launch party.
I've always loved Foyles. When I first started coming down to London, the old Foyles, and indeed the new Foyles, was right next to the Astoria, where there loads of rock gigs would play. And I was still underage at the time, and so I couldn't go and meet in the pubs with all of the cool grown-ups. And so before gigs used to come on, I used to just walk around Foyles for hours before going to see some kind of dirty, heavy rock band. I knew its toilets intimately. So to be invited along to its beautiful, new, glamorous Two Doors Down makeover was an utter thrill and honour.
What do you think?
Oh, it's beautiful. I mean, it's a combination of kind of calm, sexy, intellectual thoughtfulness with a slight frisson of people looking over the top of bookshelves at each other going, will we get off with each other? In other words, the perfect bookshop.
The writer Catlin Moran at the launch party of Foyle's new flagship store at 107 Charing Cross Road. For Monocle, in London, I'm Georgina Godwin.
The Foyles Grand Opening Festival continues to Friday the 4th of July with an all-star programme of events to launch that new space. And if you want to hear more about the grand unveiling, tune into the weekend edition with Georgina this Saturday from 8 a.m. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Next time we'll be finding out what's going down at this year's Art Basel, and I'll be speaking to the king of the camera, Wolfgang Tillmans. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and my producer was Holly Fisher. And talking of wind tunnels, she to me is like the spirit of ecstasy on the front of a Rolls Royce. Time for one final song this week from Alexis Taylor. Here he is with Overlapping Fabrics. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in. ¶¶
over, over beer, and welcome the parts that were uncharted. And what emerges guides us here. I thought we had never heard so empty. We're nothing but loose. We're nothing but losing. Is that what you say?